Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement, the 1980 book for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and legendary beings that I find therein, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is the first in our series about the Central American Mythology chapter of Deities and Demigods. So let's get started. I'm a little skeptical about this category of Central American mythology. I understand why it is the way it is. Now, the Central American mythology chapter covers the mythology of both the Aztec and Maya peoples. And in fact, many of the elements of those mythologies are shared with other cultures as well. So for example, the Aztecs have aspects of their own religious belief, but they also share some others with other cultures in Central and Northern Mexico, both like outside the Aztec Empire and historically earlier than the Aztecs. But leaving that aside, it seems to me that Aztec and Maya mythology are different enough that I'm not sure you can really lump them together. Certainly, this is a book that has separate chapters for Babylonian and Sumerian mythology, which are much more similar to each other, at least the way I see it. But never mind. The book presents us with Central American mythology, so Central American mythology we shall cover, and I will try to always make it clear which thing we're talking about comes from Aztec mythology, which thing comes from Maya mythology, and which thing is a combination of both. The mythologies of the Aztec and Maya cultures were interconnected, but they were not identical. There was cultural contact between these two different parts of mostly modern-day Mexico, and they were certainly influenced by some of the same ideas. And you can see some of the commonalities when you think about the importance of religion in their social structures, the role that sacrifice, including human sacrifice, played, and a few other things, such as certain aspects of their cosmology, certain aspects of their ritual. But they were also very different in important ways, and can be difficult to sort of sum them up as a single thing. And let's start with the Aztecs. You know, the term Aztec is rather a confusing historical one. It's often used quite imprecisely. Here, it's being used in probably its, like, colloquial sense, which is that their Aztecs are the people who inhabited the kind of Valley of Mexico and Central Mexico in the late Middle Ages and up into the 1500s. So this is the period of the so-called Aztec Empire, really an alliance of, or well, you know, maybe not a fully voluntary alliance, of different city-states centered on the capital of Tenochtitlan in the region of what is today Mexico City. These people spoke the Nahuatl language, although not everybody who spoke that language was part of the Aztec polity. Certainly many people that we today, in like common conversation, would refer to as Aztecs would not have used that term for themselves. The Maya civilization flourished south of the Aztecs, so in southern Mexico and to what is today Honduras, Belize, and Guatemala. And that covers the area of the Yucatan Peninsula, but also other regions as well, including the kind of highland region of the Sierra Madre. And it's important to remember that within the broader kind of Maya cultural zone, there are differences, and those regional differences are among them. When we talk about the Maya civilization, we're really talking about a number of different things. It's a very long-lived culture with a variety of distinct historical periods. What you think of when you think of the Maya, probably the classic Maya period, which is somewhat earlier than the Aztec era, right? It's kind of the late antique and early medieval periods. To put it another way, obviously the Aztecs are around during like the Renaissance, right? The conquest of the Aztec Empire happens sort of from 1519 to 1521. And the classic Maya period is contemporary with like the Vikings, or a little bit earlier. You know, the tail end of the classic Maya period is happening around the kind of height of the Viking Age. So just to give you some sense of the differences between those two best-known periods of those cultures. But of course, there were, you know, Maya-speaking peoples and Maya polities at the time of the Aztec Empire in what's called the post-classical period. And we know that the Maya culture did have contact with civilizations further north in Mexico, so obviously in the post-classical period from the Aztecs, and earlier than that, the cultures of places like Teotihuacan, which flourished somewhat before the Aztec period. Both the Aztec and Maya cultures had written languages, and these languages were used both in monumental epigraphs and also in the production of documents. But following Spanish colonization, the Spanish destroyed many of these documents. So our historical sources, our contemporary sources for these mythologies are kind of limited. We do have a few remarkable texts. Probably the most famous text about Aztec culture and history is the Florentine Codex, which was compiled in the 16th century by Friar Bernardo de Sahagún, who, working together with Nahua speakers, produced a joint Nahuatl-Spanish document that's still one of the most important sources for Aztec studies today. In the case of Maya, the writing system for the Mayan language, Maya people, Mayan language, that writing system went out of use and was replaced, I think, by just writing the Mayan language in Latin characters. And so many of those older inscriptions were not understood by modern scholars until much later. However, we do have a number of texts, you know, Latin renditions of the Mayan language, or languages, I should say. It's actually a number of somewhat different languages. I'm no expert on Mayan linguistics, but that's my understanding. The most famous of which is the Popol Vuh, which is a legendary or mythological text about all kinds of stuff, including, most famously, the adventures of these hero twins. So we actually do have a good blend of sources for the mythology of these cultures, together with sources for their religious practices. These are a snapshot of a diverse and changing culture. And it's very important not to consign these. This is something we're going to really talk about when we get to the Native American section, what this book calls the American Indian section, which is that I don't want to put these cultures in the past, right? And just say that, like, oh, I mean, just because the Spanish conquest ends the Aztec Empire, that it ends the culture of those people. You know, these are living languages, and mythology and folklore are always evolving and changing over time. With that said, let's take a look at how deities and demigods presents the gods and other beings of Aztec and Maya mythology. You know, the brief introductions at the beginnings of these sections are very interesting, but I do feel that maybe it's a mistake that they are so brief. The Deities and Demigods book is very focused on what its title suggests, deities and demigods. But actually, the cast of characters, the pantheon, is maybe not the most important part of any religious belief, right? I mean, when you think about, I don't know, ancient Greek mythology, you certainly think about Zeus and Hera and Aphrodite and Hephaestus and so on and so forth, but at the same time, it's almost more important to think about what are the concepts that underlie the religion of that culture, because you're going to miss out on a lot if you just think of religion as a series of exciting stories about the adventures of gods and heroes. So this section talks a little bit about the cosmology of Aztec and Maya religion, but it struggles with it partly because, you know, space is limited, partly because it's trying to fit it into a Dungeons and Dragons context, and partly because it has two quite distinct religions to kind of try and fuse into one. So this section starts out with this idea that the gods of Mesoamerican mythology have a slightly different relationship to the planar structure than gods of other mythoi. And I think this is to do with the idea that the gods of the Aztec mythology come from somewhere else. There's a thing about kind of cycles of creation. This is tied in to the idea of sacrifice in Aztec mythology, because our world, the fifth sun, was created by an act of sacrifice. Acts of sacrifice are necessary to maintain it. Similarly, the section here says that these gods are quite alien in their thought. Well, I don't necessarily know about that, but it is definitely the case that if you're used to very, very humanized deities like you would find in Greek mythology or Norse mythology, then certainly the deities of Aztec mythology are going to feel, or Maya mythology to that matter, are going to feel a little bit odd. They are less human in their scale, and their concerns are less, you know, there's less of a sense that they are, you know, humans writ large, or even not all that large. But I don't know that I would say that they're completely inhuman in their motivations, as we shall see as we go on. Then we're told that clerics form an elite of the population. And this is probably true to a certain extent. We know that these were both centralized states. You know, if we're talking about the Aztecs at the in the kind of, you know, 15 teens and the Maya during the classic Maya period, these are centralized states with, you know, complex religious bureaucracies, you know, where religion and state are very, very closely intertwined, you know, systems where religious ceremonies and sacrifices are a vital part of the, you know, the functions of the community. It also says that clerics are associated with particular directions. It is definitely true that deities in both Aztec and Maya mythology are sometimes associated with directions. Often specific deities have this directional quality to them, and that particular colors are also associated with directions. It's kind of a fun idea that clerics from kind of Mesoamerican influenced cultures have this sort of propitious direction where they get bonuses if they're going or facing in that direction and penalties if they're not. Now, I think that in practice, this would be kind of a nuisance to track, but it is a relatively common, the idea of things being propitious or not being propitious is very common in a wide variety of cultures and doesn't appear in their fantasy equivalents very much, presumably because it's something that sort of reduces player agency. But here it's presented as a gimmick that can be exploited for tactical gain, which is exactly the kind of thing that D&D players traditionally like, and therefore I think it's pretty effective. We're also told that these deities are quite strict in terms of how they punish erring clerics, and those can lead to social penalties, such as the loss of wealth, but also the loss of experience levels. Now, these are deities whose wrath is not to be tempted, which would tend to suggest that clerics of these deities, even more so than in other mythoi, will tend to be quite strict in their observance of, like, the letter of their deity's law, which is fine. And one of the things that is a shame is that this section doesn't talk very much about cosmology. Doesn't talk about the things that religions frequently address, right? What is the right way to behave? Who made the world? What's going to happen to me when I die? Now, we will see some of these emerge in the individual deities throughout this, and then at the end of the series, we're going to do a wrap-up on them, because this is maybe, other than, I guess, like, the Cthulhu mythos, the section where we have the least, kind of like, we are bringing the least knowledge of this to the table. I think there's almost nobody out there in the English-speaking cultural world who doesn't have some sense of what Greek mythology is like. It's just such a prevalent topic in, you know, writing and art and whatever, and it might be wrong, but we have an instinct about it, and to a lesser extent that's true of Norse mythology. We may be in less charted ground, at least for more people, than we have been up to this point. And then, of course, we move into a discussion of the chief god of the Central American pantheon, in so far as we can say that there is one, Quetzalcoatl. Now, Quetzalcoatl is the Nahuatl name for the feathered serpent deity, and indeed that's basically just what Quetzalcoatl means. The Maya name is Kukulkan, which is the name given first in the section following the stat block, and also says that Quetzalcoatl is called Ehecatl, who is the wind god and is a humanoid form. And that's another Aztec name, another Nahuatl name. Now, the belief in the feathered serpent deity seems to predate the certainly predates the Aztec culture. Probably the most famous ritual center devoted to Quetzalcoatl is at Teotihuacan, and that's, you know, that's much earlier than the Aztecs proper. In the Aztec period, the major ritual center focused on Quetzalcoatl is at Cholula. In Maya culture, Kukulkan, there are earlier Maya deities who appear in the form of serpents, often called the Vision Serpent and the War Serpent, and Quetzalcoatl seems to be associated with the Vision Serpent. It's possible that what's happening here is that existing serpent-like Maya deities are kind of being drifted into a form that's more similar to the feathered serpent deities of the north, you know, of central Mexico, and then that is kind of like facilitating cultural contact, trade between these two areas, and also maybe strengthening some Maya cities so that they develop more centralized governing systems like their northern neighbors, that Quetzalcoatl comes to symbolize the state in some way. It says that he appears in a bewildering number of forms, which is true, and that's going to be true of a lot of Aztec deities, that they have a lot of different aspects. I should say that deity is actually kind of a complex concept here, that the Aztec term is teotl, supernaturally powerful beings or supernatural forces. Certainly the Spanish come along and they go, oh, okay, these are pagan gods like Zeus and whatnot. But there may not be a one-for-one correspondence between certainly the Aztec concept of what these things are and the European idea of a god, which is something that we saw in Chinese mythology as well, right? That the boundaries between the human and the divine are a lot blurrier than you might think, though that's actually true in, say, Greek mythology as well, right? And Quetzalcoatl is a wind god, a storm god. There are Nahuatl texts that talk about how when he becomes angry, that's what storms are. You know, when the sky becomes dark and the wind is blowing in all directions, then it is said Quetzalcoatl is wrathful. He's also associated with rulership. Symbols of Quetzalcoatl are often marks of office. As a fighter, Quetzalcoatl is described as a paladin here, which I think is probably right. There are a number of different mythologies of Quetzalcoatl, and I think that that speaks to his importance to Mesoamerican cultures. There are lots of different stories about, you know, who he is and where he came from. And there are also uses of Quetzalcoatl as a title or a personal name. So there's some sense that people can kind of cloak themselves in the authority of Quetzalcoatl. One common item associated with Quetzalcoatl is the wind breastplate. And this is basically a shell ornament with a spiral marking on it, which is meant to represent the whirlwind. And it's you see Quetzalcoatl depicted wearing it, and then there are also artifacts that are somewhat similar to it, or that are inspired by its appearance, and they seem to be badges of authority. So Quetzalcoatl is a god of the wind, and he's a god of wisdom, and he's a god associated with rulership. It's not necessarily the king of the gods in the way that we could apply that term to Odin or to Zeus, right? These are deities who we see in a monarchy kind of social structure, and people, you know, the other characters in the myth think of them as the ruler. He's certainly a very important deity, and he's associated as a kind of patron of learning and knowledge, and therefore a patron of the priesthood, who have this very powerful role in Mesoamerican society. But I don't know that he's necessarily the head of a divine hierarchy. Certainly one of the most important gods. But I think we're going to find precise hierarchies a little more difficult to establish in our look at Central American mythology than others. And of course, as we saw with the Maya example, we're also going to see him venerated differently in different places. There can be particular areas that are important cult centers of Quetzalcoatl. I mentioned the Great Pyramid of Cholula. I visited it once when I was very young. I don't think we stayed for any length of time. It kind of just looks like a hill, but it's the largest pyramid in the New World. And it's got a church on top of it, which is it's pretty striking looking, even sort of covered up with earth. You know, I think that the complexity and ambiguity and the many different roles played by Quetzalcoatl actually make him an ideal deity for a Dungeons & Dragons game. He can kind of fit into a number of different roles. And if you don't want to be constrained by the Aztec mythology, or if you don't want to feel like you have to do a bunch of historical research, or if you are concerned, I mean, I think, you know, when you're dealing with something like Aztec or Maya mythology, there's always this kind of, you know, our knowledge of these things is something that is inextricably intertwined with colonialism in a way that is just kind of not as true for Norse mythology, although some have argued that the Christianization of Scandinavia is in a sense a form of colonialism, but I'm not sure I find that argument convincing. But anyway, you know, if you don't want to have those specific associations, I think there's definitely room for this feathered serpent, you know, living in the boundary between earth and sky, acting as a bringer of knowledge, either of mystical enlightenment or of learning, you know, a weather god. Has a bunch of different roles and is associated, you know, something that exists in a bunch of different cultures. And I think that, you know, one thing that we don't see very much of in fantasy games is, although, I mean, getting Glorantha the standout exception here, is getting the same deities and having them appear in different cultures in different forms. So I think it'd be quite interesting to do something like that with Quetzalcoatl. I think he's a good candidate for the job. Okay, in our next episode, we're going to take a look at a couple more deities from Mesoamerican mythology. I don't know how many we're going to get to, but we're at least going to cover Camachtli, the god of fate, and Camazotz, the bat god, who has some very cool imagery associated with them. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.